Chapter 4. Freedom. Freedom implies, does it not, that you must not follow anyone. You must be free to inquire, not accept, not look to a guide, to a system, to a savior, to a guru. Freedom implies that you must have the capacity to inquire, not into what others say, but to inquire within yourself, to investigate, to examine the whole structure of a human mind. That is, our mind, your mind. Any form of conformity, imitation according to a pattern, a mold, does not allow free inquiry. And what we are going to talk about demands that you be free to listen, not only to the word, but to the meaning of the word, and not to be a slave to the word, not accept whatever the speaker says, or deny what he says, but listen to find out. To find out for yourself, not according to some interpretation, not according to some other speaker, but to find out for yourself the truth or the falseness of what is being said. Freedom is not to do what you want to do. That is not freedom at all. And I think probably that freedom has brought about great misery in the world. Each one doing exactly what he wants to do. That is rampant in this country, where there is no tradition, where there is no discipline. I am using the word discipline in a totally different sense, which we will go into presently. Freedom does not imply choice. One thinks one is free if you can choose. I do not know if you have ever gone into this question of choice. You have a vast array in front of you, the various teachers, yogis, philosophers, scientists, psychologists, analysts, bombarding your mind constantly, day in and day out. And from this array, you are going to choose whom you think you should follow, whom you think you should listen to. You choose according to your temperament, according to your desire, according to your pleasure. Please do listen to this, if you will, carefully, because you are confronted with this problem when so many of them are telling you, follow this and don't follow that, and do this and do that. And you are faced with the question of whom to listen to and whom to follow, whether that teacher, that philosophy, that guru. You are not free, and it is absolutely necessary to be free to find out what is true and what is false for yourself, which no one can tell you, no system, no philosophy, no guru. When you face this array of teachers, philosophers, and systems, you are forced, because you yourself are confused, life has become terrible, painful, uncertain, there is so much poverty, the threat of destruction, violence, and you want to escape from all that. You are forced to choose one of these. And your choice is based upon your confusion, naturally, whether to follow, to listen to that teacher, to that guru, to that philosopher. So you begin to depend on yourself, thinking you are free to choose. The background of choice is invariably confusion. Aren't you confused when you choose? Aren't you uncertain when you pick one amongst all these? So your choice is essentially the outcome of confusion. I think it must be fairly obvious to most of us that what we think is conditioned. Whatever your thought, however noble and wide, or however limited and petty, it is conditioned. And if you further that thought, there can be no freedom of thought. Thought itself is conditioned because thought is the reaction of memory. And memory is the residue of all your experiences, which in turn are the result of your conditioning. If we realize that all thinking, at whatever level, is conditioned, then we will see that thinking is not the means of breaking through this limitation, which does not mean that we must go into some blank or speculative silence. Actually, the fact is it not, that every thought, every feeling, every action is conformative, conditioned, influenced. For instance, a saint comes along, and by his rhetoric, gestures, looks, by quoting this and that to you, influences you. And we want to be influenced, and are afraid to move away from every form of influence, and see if we can go deeply and discover if there is a state of being which is not the result of influence. Why are we influenced? In politics, as you know, it is the job of the politician to influence us. And every book, every teacher, every guru, the more powerful, the more eloquent, the better we like it, imposes his thought, his way of life, his manner of conduct upon us. So life is a battle of ideas, a battle of influences, and your mind is the field of the battle. The politician wants your mind. The guru wants your mind. The saint says, do this and not that, and he also wants your mind. And every tradition, every form of habit or custom, influences, shapes, guides, controls your mind. I think that is fairly obvious. It would be absurd to deny it. We are saying that a mind that is influenced, shaped, authority-bound, obviously can never be free. And whatever it thinks, however lofty its ideals, however subtle and deep, it is still conditioned. I think it is very important to understand that the mind, through time, through experience, through the many thousands of yesterdays, is shaped, conditioned, and that thought is not the way out. Which does not mean that you must be thoughtless. On the contrary, when you are capable of understanding very profoundly, very deeply, extensively, widely, subtly, then only will you fully recognize how petty thinking is, how small thought is. Then there is a breaking down of the wall of that conditioning. So can we not see the fact that all thought is conditioned? Whether it is the thought of the communist, capitalist, Hindu, Buddhist, or the person who is speaking, thinking is conditioned. And obviously the mind is the result of time, the result of the reactions of 1,000 years and of yesterday, of 1 second ago and 10 years ago. The mind is the result of the period in which you have learnt and suffered, and of all the influences of the past and present. Now, such a mind, obviously, cannot be free. And yet, that is what we are seeking, is it not? Being discontented when young, being dissatisfied with things as they are, with the stupidities of traditional values, we gradually, as we grow older, fall into the old patterns which society has established, and we get lost. It is very difficult to keep the pure discontent, the discontent which says, this is not enough, there must be something else. We all know that feeling, the feeling of otherness, which we soon translate as God or Nirvana, and we read a book about it and get lost. But this feeling of otherness, the search, the inquiry for it, that, I think, is the beginning of the real urge to be free from all these political, religious, and traditional influences, and to break through this wall. Surely there are several kinds of freedom. There is political freedom. There is the freedom which knowledge gives, when you know how to do things, the know-how. The freedom of a wealthy man who can go around the world. The freedom of capacity, to be able to write, to express oneself, to think clearly. Then there is the freedom from something, freedom from oppression, freedom from envy, freedom from tradition, from ambition, and so on. And then there is the freedom which is gained, we hope, at the end of the discipline, at the end of acquiring virtue, at the end of effort, the ultimate freedom we hope to get by certain things. So the freedom that capacity gives, the freedom from something, and the freedom we are supposed to gain at the end of a virtuous life, those are types of freedom we all know. Now, are not those various freedoms merely reactions? When you say, "I want to be free from anger," that is merely a reaction. It is not freedom from anger. And the freedom which you think that you will get at the end of a virtuous life, by struggle, by discipline, that is also a reaction to what has been. There is a sense of freedom which is not from anything, which has no cause, but which is a state of being free. You see, the freedom that we know is always brought about by will, is it not? I will be free. I will learn a technique. I will become a specialist. I will study. And that will give me freedom. So we use will as a means of achieving freedom, do we not? I do not want to be poor, and therefore I exercise my capacity, my will, everything to get rich. Or I am vain, and I exercise will not to be vain. So we think we shall get freedom through the exercise of will. But will does not bring freedom. I will be. I must not be. I am going to struggle to become something. I am going to learn. All these are forms of exercising will. Now, what is this will? And how is it formed? Obviously, through desire. Our many desires, with their frustrations, compulsions, and fulfillments, form, as it were, the threads of a cord, a rope. That is will, is it not? Your many contradictory desires together become a very strong and powerful rope with which you try to climb to success, to freedom. Now, will desire give freedom? Or is the very desire for freedom the denial of it? Please watch yourselves, watch your own desires, your own ambition, your own will. And if one has no will and is merely being driven, that also is a part of will, the will to resist and go with the tide. Through that weight of desire, through that rope, we hope to climb to God, to bliss, or whatever it is. So I am asking you whether your will is a liberating factor, or is freedom something entirely different, which has nothing to do with reaction, which cannot be achieved through capacity, through thought, experience, discipline, or constant conformity. That is what all the books say, do they not? Conform to the pattern, and you will be free in the end. Do all these things, obey, and ultimately there will be freedom. To me, all that is sheer nonsense, because freedom is at the beginning, not at the end, as I will show you. To see something true is possible, is it not? You can see that the sky is blue. Thousands of people have said so. But you can see that it is so for yourself. You can see for yourself, if you are at all sensitive, the movement of a leaf. From the very beginning, there is the capacity to perceive that which is true, instinctively, not through any form of compulsion, adjustment, conformity. I am trying to show you that a mind that is sensitive, inquiring, a mind that is really listening, can perceive the truth of something immediately. But truth cannot be applied. If you see the truth, it operates without your conscious effort, of its own accord. Discontent is the beginning of freedom. And so long as you are trying to manipulate discontent, to accept authority, in order that this discontent shall disappear, enter into safe channels, then you are already losing that pristine sense of real feeling. Most of us are discontented, are we not? Either with our jobs, our relationships, or whatever we are doing. You want something to happen, to change, to move, to break through. You do not know what it is. There is a constant searching, inquiring, especially when one is young, open, sensitive. Later on, as you become old, you settle down in your habits, your job, because your family is safe. Your wife will not run away. So this extraordinary flame disappears, and you become respectable, petty, and thoughtless. Freedom is a quality of the mind. That quality does not come about through very careful, respectable searchings and inquiries, through very careful analysis, or putting ideas together. That is why it is important to see the truth that the freedom we are constantly demanding is always from something, such as freedom from sorrow. Not that there is no freedom from sorrow, but the demand to be free from it is merely a reaction, and therefore does not free you from sorrow. The urge to be free of sorrow is born out of pain. I suffer because of my husband or my son or something else. I do not like that state I am in, and I want to get away from it. That desire for freedom is a reaction. It is not freedom. It is just another desirable state I want in opposition to what is. The man who can travel around the world because he has plenty of money is not necessarily free. Nor is the man who is clever or efficient, for his wanting to be free is again merely a reaction. Can I not see that freedom, liberation, cannot be learned or acquired or sought after through any reaction? Therefore, I must understand the reaction, and I must also understand that freedom does not come through any effort of will. Will and freedom are contradictory, as thought and freedom are contradictory. Thought cannot produce freedom, because thought is conditioned. Economically, you can, perhaps, arrange the world so that man can be more comfortable, have more food, clothing, and shelter, and you may think that is freedom. Those are necessary and essential things, but that is not the totality of freedom. Freedom is a state and quality of mind, and it is that quality we are inquiring into. Without that quality, do what you will, cultivate all the virtues in the world, you will not have that freedom. How is that sense of otherness, that quality of mind, to come about? You cannot cultivate it, because the moment you use your brain, you are using thought, which is limited. Whether it is the thought of the Buddha or anyone else, all thought is limited. So our inquiry must be negative. We must come to that freedom obliquely, not directly. That freedom is not to be sought after aggressively, is not to be cultivated by denials, disciplines, by checking yourself, torturing yourself, by doing various exercises, and all the rest of it. It must come without your knowing, like virtue. Cultivated virtue is not virtue. The virtue which is true virtue is not self-conscious. Surely a man who has cultivated humility, who, because of his conceit, vanity, arrogance, has made himself humble, such a man has no true sense of humility. Humility is a state in which the mind is not conscious of its own quality, as a flower which has fragrance is not conscious of its own perfume. This freedom cannot be got through any form of discipline, nor can a mind which is undisciplined understand it. You use discipline to produce a result, but freedom is not a result. If it is a result, it is no longer free, because it has been produced. How is the mind, which is full of multitudinous influences, compulsions, various forms of contradictory desires, the product of time, how is that mind to have the quality of freedom? We know that all the things that I have been talking about are not freedom. They are all manufactured by the mind under various stresses, compulsions, and influences. If I can approach it negatively in the very awareness that all this is not freedom, then the mind is already disciplined, but not disciplined to achieve a result. The mind says, I must discipline myself in order to achieve a result. But such discipline does not bring freedom. It brings a result, because you have a motive, a cause, which produces the result. But that result is never freedom. It is only a reaction. Now, if I begin to understand the operations of that kind of discipline, then in the very process of understanding, inquiring, going into it, my mind is truly disciplined. The exercise of will to produce a result is called discipline. Whereas the understanding of the whole significance of will, of discipline, and of what we call result, demands a mind that is extraordinarily clear and disciplined, not by the will, but through negative understanding. So, negatively, I have understood the whole problem of what is not freedom. I have examined it. I have searched my heart and my mind, the recesses of my being, to understand what freedom means. And I see that none of these things we have described is freedom, because they are all based on desire, compulsion, will, on what I will get at the end, and they are all reactions. I see factually that they are not freedom. Therefore, because I have understood those things, my mind is open to find out or receive that which is free. So my mind has a quality which is not that of a disciplined mind seeking a result, nor that of the undisciplined mind which wanders about. But it has understood negatively both what is and what should be, and so can perceive, can understand that freedom which is not from something, that freedom which is not a result. The universe cannot enter into the petty mind. The immeasurable cannot come to a mind that knows measurement. So our whole inquiry is how to break through the measurement, which does not mean I must go off to an ashram, become neurotic, devotional, and all that nonsense. And here, if I may say so, what is important is the teaching and not the teacher. The person who speaks here at the moment is not important. Throw him overboard. What is important is what is being said. So the mind only knows the measurable, the compass of itself, the frontiers, ambitions, hopes, desperation, misery, sorrows, and joys. Such a mind cannot invite freedom. All that it can do is to be aware of itself and not condemn what it sees, not condemn the ugly or cling to the beautiful, but see what is. The mere perception of what is the beginning of the breaking down of the measurement of the mind, of its frontiers, its patterns, just to see things as they are. Then you will find that the mind can come to that freedom involuntarily, without knowing. This transformation in the mind itself is the true revolution. All other revolutions are reactions, even though they use the word freedom and promise utopia, the heavens, everything. There is only true revolution in the quality of the mind. I am not at all sure that most of us want to be completely free. Rather, we should like to keep some pleasurable, satisfying, complex ideologies and gratifying formulas. We should, of course, like to be free of those things that are painful, the ugly memories, painful experiences, and so on. We all say we would like to be free, but I think that before we pursue that desire, with which our inclinations or tendencies confront us, we should understand the nature and the structure of freedom. Is it freedom when you are free from something, free from pain, free from some kind of anxiety? Or is not freedom itself entirely different from freedom from something? One can be free from anger, perhaps from jealousy, but is not freedom from something a reaction, and therefore not freedom at all? Is not freedom something entirely different from any reaction, any inclination, any desire? One can be free from dogma very easily by analyzing, kicking it out. Yet the motive for that freedom from a dogma contains its own reaction, doesn't it? The motive, the desire to be free from a dogma, may be that it is no longer convenient, no longer fashionable, no longer reasonable, no longer popular. Circumstances are against it, and therefore you want to be free from it. These are merely reactions. Is reaction away from anything freedom? Or is freedom something entirely different from reaction, standing by itself, without any motive, not dependent upon any inclination, tendency, and circumstance? Is there such a thing as that kind of freedom? Can a leader, spiritual or political, promise freedom at the end of something? For can freedom which comes about through discipline, through conformity, through acceptance, that promises the ideal through the following of that ideal, be freedom? Or is freedom a state of mind which is so intensely active, vigorous, that it throws away every form of dependence, slavery, conformity, and acceptance? Does the mind want such freedom? Such freedom implies complete solitude, a state of mind which is not dependent on circumstantial stimulation, ideas, experience. Freedom of that kind obviously means aloneness, solitude. Can the mind brought up in a culture that is so dependent upon environment, on its own tendencies, inclinations, ever find that freedom which is completely alone? It is only in such solitude that there can be relationship with another. In it there is no friction, no dominance, no dependence. Please, you have to understand this. It is not just a verbal conclusion which you accept or deny. Is this what each individual demands and insists upon? A freedom in which there is no leadership, no tradition, no authority. Otherwise, there is not freedom. Otherwise, when you say you are free from something, it is merely a reaction, which, because it is a reaction, is going to be the cause of another reaction. One can have a chain of reactions, accepting each reaction as a freedom. But that chain is not freedom. It is a continuity of the modified past to which the mind clings. Freedom is complete in itself. It is not a reaction. It is not an ideological conclusion. Freedom implies complete solitude, an inward state of mind that is not dependent on any stimulus, on any knowledge. It is not the result of any experience or conclusion. In understanding freedom, we also understand what is implied in solitude. Most of us, inwardly, are never alone. There is a difference between isolation, cutting oneself off, and aloneness, solitude. We know what it is to be isolated, to have built a wall around oneself, a wall of resistance, a wall which we have built in order never to be vulnerable. Or we may live in a dreamy, idiotic ideology, which has no validity at all. All these bring about self-isolation, and in our daily life, in the office, at home, in our sexual relationships, in every activity, this process of self-isolation is going on. That form of isolation, and living in an ivory tower of ideology, has nothing whatsoever to do with solitude, with aloneness. The state of solitude, aloneness, can only come about when there is freedom from the psychological structure of society, which we have built through our reactions, and of which we are. In understanding total freedom, we come upon the sense of complete solitude. I feel that it is only a mind that has understood this solitude that can have relationship in which there is no conflict whatsoever. But if we create an image of what we think is solitude and establish that as the basis of solitude in ourselves, and from that try to find a relationship, then such relationship will only bring about conflict. We human beings who have lived so long, gathered so much experience, are second-hand entities. There is nothing original. We are contaminated by every kind of torture, conflict, obedience, acceptance, fear, jealousy, anxiety, and therefore there is not that quality of aloneness. We as human beings, as we are only a result, a psychological product. All our relationships are based on what has been or what should be. Therefore, all relationship is a conflict, a battlefield. If one would understand what is right relationship, one must inquire into the nature and the structure of solitude, which is to be completely alone. But that word alone creates an image. Watch yourself. You will see. When you use that word alone, you have already a formula, an image, and you try to live up to that image, to that formula. But the word or the image is not the fact. One has to understand and live with that which actually is. Understanding solitude, if you really know what it means and live in that state, is really quite extraordinary. Because then the mind is always fresh and is not dependent upon inclination, tendency, nor guided by circumstance. In understanding solitude, you will begin to understand the necessity of living with yourself as you actually are. In observing myself, I find I am jealous, anxious, or envious. I realize that. Now, I want to live with that because it is only when I live with something intimately that I begin to understand it. But to live with my envy, with my anxiety, is one of the most difficult things. I see that the moment I get used to it, I am not living with it. There is that river, and I can see it every day, hear the sound of it, the lapping of the water. But after 2 or 3 days, I have got used to it, and I don't always hear it. I can have a picture in the room. I have looked at it every day, at the beauty, the color, the various depths and shadows, the quality of it. Yet, having looked at it for a week, I have lost it. I have got used to it. And the same happens with the mountains, with the valleys, the rivers, the trees, with the family, with my wife, with my husband. But to live with a living thing, like jealousy, envy, means that I can never accept it. I can never get used to it. I must care for it as I would care for a newly planted tree. I must protect it against the sun, against the storm. In the same way, I have to live with this anxiety and envy. I must care for it, not get used to it, not condemn it. In this way, I began to love it and to care for it, which is not that I love to be envious or anxious, but rather that I care for the watching. It is like living with a snake in the room. Gradually, I began to see my immediate relationship to it, and there is no conflict. Can you and I live with what we actually are? Being dull, envious, fearful, thinking that we have tremendous affection when we have not, getting easily hurt, flattered, bored. Can we live with these actualities, neither accepting nor denying, but observing, living with them without becoming morbid, depressed, or elated? Then you will find that one of the major reasons for fear is that we don't want to live with what we are. We have talked first of freedom, then of solitude, and then of being aware of what we are, and also of how what we are is related to the past and has a movement towards the future, of being aware of this and living with it, never getting used to it, never accepting it. If we understand this, not intellectually, but through actually doing it, then we can ask a further question. Is this freedom, this solitude, this actual coming into immediate contact with the whole structure of what is, to be found or to be come upon through time? That is freedom to be achieved through time, through a gradual process? I am not free because I am anxious. I am fearful. I am this. I am that. I am afraid of death. I am afraid of my neighbor. I am afraid of losing my job. I am afraid of my husband turning against me. Of all the things that one has built up through life, I am not free. I can be free by getting rid of them one by one, throwing them out. But that is not freedom. Is freedom to be achieved through time? Obviously not. For the moment you introduce time, there is a process. You are enslaving yourself more and more. If I am to be free from violence gradually through the practice of nonviolence, then in the gradual practice, I am sowing the seeds of violence all the time. So we are asking a very fundamental question when we ask whether freedom is to be achieved, or rather, whether it comes into being through time. The next question is, can one be conscious of that freedom? If one says, I am free, then one is not free. So freedom, the freedom of which we are talking, is not something resulting from a conscious effort to achieve it. Therefore, it lies beyond all, beyond the field of consciousness. And it is not a matter of time. Time is consciousness. Time is sorrow. Time is fear of thought. When you say, I have realized that complete freedom, then you certainly know, if you are really honest with yourself, that you are back where you were. It is like a man saying, I am happy. The moment he says, I am happy, he is living the memory of that which is gone. Freedom is not of time, and the mind has to look at life, which is a vast movement, without the bondage of time. Freedom demands space. There cannot be inward freedom if there is no inward space. The word space is different from the fact, so may I suggest that you don't seize upon that word and get caught in trying to analyze or define it. Now, can we put to ourselves the question, what is space? And remain there, not trying to define the word, not trying to feel our way into it, or to inquire into it, but rather to see what it means non-verbally. Freedom and space go together. To most of us, space is the emptiness around an object, around a chair, around a building, around a person, or around the contours of the mind. Most of us know space only because of the object. There is an object, and around it there is what we call space. There is this tent. The talk is taking place in a large tent. And within and around it there is space. There is space around that tree, around that mountain. We know space only within the four walls of a building, or outside the building, or around some object. Similarly, we know space inwardly only from the center which looks out at it. There is a center, the image. if I may go back to that word, and again, the word image is not the fact, and around this center there is space. So we know space only because of the object within that space. Now, is there space without the object, without the center from which you, as a human being, are looking? Space, as we know it, has to do with design, structure. It exists in the relationship of one structure to another structure, one center to another center. Now, if space exists only because of the object, or because the mind has a center from which it is looking out, then that space is limited, and therefore, in that space, there is no freedom. To be free in a prison is not freedom. To be free of a certain problem within the four walls of one's relationships, that is, within the limited space of one's own image, one's own thoughts, activities, ideas, conclusions, is not freedom. Please, may I once again suggest that through the words of the speaker, you observe the limited space which you have created around yourself as a human being in relationship with another. As a human being living in a world of destruction and brutality, as a human being in a relationship to a particular society, observe your own space. See how limited it is. I do not mean the size of the room in which you live, whether it is small or big. That is not what I am talking about. I mean the inner space which each one of us has created around his own image, around a center, around a conclusion. So the only space we know is the space which has an object as its center. Now, to understand freedom in relationship, one must go into this question of what is space, because the minds of most of us are small, petty, limited. We are heavily conditioned by religion, by the society in which we live, by our education, by technology. We are limited, forced to conform to a certain pattern, and one sees that there is no freedom within that circumscribed area. But one demands freedom, complete freedom, not just partial freedom. Living in a prison cell for 24 hours a day, and going occasionally into the prison yard to walk around there, that is not freedom. As a human being living in the present society, with all its confusion, misery, conflict, torture, one demands freedom, and this demand for freedom is a healthy, normal thing. Living in society, living in relationship with your family, with your property, with your ideas, what does it mean to be free? Can the mind ever be free if it hasn't got limitless space within itself? Space not created by an idea of space, not created by an image which has a certain limited space around itself as the center. Surely, as a human being, one has to find out the relationship that exists between freedom and space. It is very important to find out for ourselves what space is. Otherwise, we shall always be in conflict with each other, in revolt against society. Merely to give up smoking, or to become a beatnik, or God knows what else, has no meaning, because those are all just forms of revolt within the prison. Now, we are trying to find out if there is such a thing as freedom which is not a revolt, freedom which is not an ideational creation of the mind, but a fact. And to find that out, one must inquire profoundly into the question of space. A petty little bourgeois middle-class mind, or an aristocratic mind, which is also petty, may think it is free, but it is not free, because it is living within the limits of its own space, the confining space created by the image in which it functions. You cannot have order without freedom. And you cannot have freedom without space. Space, freedom, and order, the three go together. They are not separate. Order is virtue, and virtue or goodness cannot flower in any society which is always in contradiction with itself. Outside influences, economic adjustment, social reform, technological progress, going to Mars, and all the rest of it, cannot possibly produce order. What produces order is inquiry into freedom. Not intellectual inquiry, but doing the actual work of breaking down our conditioning, our limiting prejudices, our narrow ideas, breaking down the whole psychological structure of society, of which we are part. Unless you break through all that, there is no freedom, and therefore there is no order. It is like a small mind trying to understand the immensity of the world, of life, of beauty. It cannot. It can imagine, it can write poems about it, paint pictures, but the reality is different from the word, different from the image, the symbol, the picture. Order can come about only through the awareness of disorder. You cannot create order. Please do see this fact. You can only be aware of disorder, outwardly as well as inwardly. A disordered mind cannot create order because it doesn't know what it means. It can only react to what it thinks is disorder by creating a pattern, which it calls order, and then conforming to that pattern. But if the mind is conscious of the disorder in which it lives, which is being aware of the negative, not projecting the so-called positive, then order becomes something extraordinarily creative, moving, living. Order is not a pattern which you follow day after day. To follow a pattern which you have established, to practice it day after day, is disorder. The disorder of effort, of conflict, of greed, of envy, of ambition, the disorder of all the petty little human beings who have created and been conditioned by the present society. Now, can one become aware of disorder, aware of it without choosing, without saying, this is disorder and that is order? Can one be choicelessly aware of disorder? This demands extraordinary intelligence, sensitivity. And in that choiceless awareness, there is also a discipline which is not mere conformity. When one examines the whole structure and meaning of discipline, whether it is imposed discipline or self-discipline, one sees that it is a form of outward or inward conformity or adjustment to a pattern, to a memory, to an experience. And we revolt against that discipline. Every human mind revolts against the stupid kind of conformity, whether established by dictators, priests, saints, gods, or whatever they are. And yet one sees that there must be some kind of discipline in life, a discipline which is not mere conformity, which is not adjustment to a pattern, which is not based on fear, and all the rest of it. Because if there is no discipline at all, one can't live. One has to find out if there is a discipline which is not conformity, because conformity destroys freedom. It never brings freedom into being. Look at the organized religions throughout the world, the political parties. It is obvious that conformity destroys freedom, and we don't have to labor the point. Either you see it or you don't see it. It is up to you. The discipline of conformity, which is created by the fear of society and is part of the psychological structure of society, is immoral and disorderly, and we are caught in it. Now, can the mind find out if there is a certain movement of discipline which is not a process of controlling, shaping, conforming? To find that out, one has to be aware of this extraordinary disorder, confusion, and misery in which one lives, and to be aware of it, not fragmentarily, but totally, and therefore choicelessly. That in itself is discipline. If I am fully aware of what I am doing, if I am choicelessly aware of the movement of my hand, for example, That very awareness is a form of discipline in which there is no conformity. You cannot understand this just verbally. You have actually to do it within yourself. Order can come about only through this sense of awareness in which there is no choice, and which is, therefore, a total awareness, a complete sensitivity to every movement of thought. This total awareness itself is discipline without conformity. Therefore, out of this total awareness of disorder, there is order. The mind hasn't produced order. To have order, which is the flowering of goodness and of beauty, there must be freedom, and there is no freedom if you have no space. So the mind has to discover by hard work, and not just by listening to some words, that there is in fact space without a center. When once that has been found, there is freedom, there is order, and then goodness and beauty flower in the human mind. Discipline, order, freedom, and space cannot exist without the understanding of time. It is very interesting to inquire into the nature of time. Time by the watch, time as yesterday, today, and tomorrow. The time in which you work, and the time in which you sleep. But there is also time which is not by the watch, and that is much more difficult to understand. We look to time as a means of bringing about order. We say, give us a few more years and we will be good, or we will create a new generation, a marvelous world. Or we talk about creating a different type of human being, one who will be totally communist, totally this or totally that. So we look to time as a means of bringing about order. But if one observes, one sees that time only breeds disorder. There must be a gap between the old and something new that may come into being. There must be a gap. And that gap takes place when you see the whole significance of the old, that the old cannot possibly give birth to the new. We all want the new because we are fed up with the old, bored. We know what the old is, and wanting the new, we don't know how to break the chain. There are gurus, teachers, and all the absurd people who say, I'll teach you how to break the chain. And their breaking the chain is still within the pattern of thought. They say, do this, don't do that, follow this, think that. But they are still caught within the system of thought. To have an insight into that doesn't require time. You see instantly how absurd this whole religious structure is, all the organization around it, the Pope, the bishops, you follow? The absurdity of all that. Grown-up people playing with childish things. If you have an insight into that, it is finished. Then you ask, how am I to have an insight? Which means you haven't actually listened. You are still holding on to your old skirts of the churches, beliefs, and ideologies. And you say, I can't let go because I am afraid. What will my neighbor think? I will lose my job. So you don't want to listen. So that is the problem. Not how to acquire perception, not how to come by insight, but rather that you don't listen to the danger of the whole thing which thought has built. And to have the insight, you have to listen. You have to let go and listen. Now, to be free of attachment doesn't mean its opposite, detachment. When we are attached, we know the pain of attachment, the anxiety of it, and we say, for God's sake, I must detach myself from all this horror. So the battle of detachment begins, the conflict. Whereas if you observe, are aware of the fact and the word attachment, and freedom from that word, which is the feeling, then observe that feeling without any judgment. Observe it. Then you will see out of that total observation, there is quite a different movement taking place, which is neither attachment or detachment. Can you be free of this attachment so that there is a responsibility which is not a duty? Then what is love when there is no attachment. Look, if you are attached to a nationality, you worship the isolation of nationality, which is a form of glorified tribalism. You are attached to it. What does that do? It breaks up, doesn't it? I am attached to my nationality as a Hindu, tremendously. And you are attached to Germany, France, Italy, England. We are separate, and the wars, and all the complexity of all that goes on. Now, if there is no attachment, and you have no attachment, what takes place? Is that love? So attachment separates. I am attached to my belief, and you are attached to your belief. Therefore, there is separation. Just see the consequences of it, the implications of it. So where there is attachment, there is separation, and therefore there is conflict. Where there is conflict, there cannot possibly be love. And what is the relationship of a man and a woman? What is his relationship to another when there is freedom from attachment, all the implications of it? Is that the beginning? I am just using the word beginning. Don't jump on it. Is that the beginning of compassion? You understand? When there is no nationality, and there is no attachment to any belief whatsoever, to any conclusion, to any ideal, then a human being is a free human being. And his relationship with another is out of freedom, isn't it? Out of love, out of compassion. It is absolutely necessary to be free to observe, free from one's prejudices, free from one's longing, free from one's fears. All that which we have talked about endlessly. Can the mind be completely without movement? Because if there is movement, there is distortion. So can the mind be completely still? And one finds it terribly difficult because thought comes in immediately. So one says, I must control thought. The controller is the controlled. We have been through all that. I won't go into it. When you see that, that the thinker is the thought, the controller is the controlled, the observer is the observed, then there is no movement. One realizes that anger is part of the observer who says, I am angry. So anger and the observer are the same. That is clear. That is simple. In the same way, the thinker who wants to control thought is still thought. When one realizes that, the movement of thought stops. When there is no movement of any kind in the mind, then, naturally, the mind is still, without effort, without compulsion, without will, without all that. It is naturally still, not cultivated stillness, because that is mechanical, which is not stillness, which is just an illusion of stillness. So there is freedom. Freedom implies all that we have talked about. And in that freedom there is silence, which means no movement. Then you can observe. Then there is observation. Then there is only observation, not the observer observing. So there is only observation out of total silence, complete stillness of mind. Then what takes place? Then there is the operation of intelligence, isn't there? Look, I'll show you. We said attachment implies great pain, anxiety, fear, and therefore deepening of possession. To see that is part of intelligence, isn't it? To see the nature of attachment and all its implications, to have an insight into it, is intelligence. I am not talking of the cunning intelligence of thought that says how true that is. If you see all the implications of attachment and see the danger of attachment, that perception is intelligence. That's all. That's all.